Your energy is dipping, and that clock has barely moved since your 1 o'clock meeting. We don't love that for you. Get your afternoon pick-me-up with a refreshing large Big Gulp drink at 7-Eleven. Cold, refreshing, and made the way you like it. It's available at 7-Eleven and just 59 cents with 7 rewards. Visit your local Columbus 7-Eleven and satisfy that craving today. Valid through 6/23/26. While supplies last, participating stores see app for full terms.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Of the 36 inmates who staged 14 escape attempts over the 29 years that Alcatraz served as a federal penitentiary, 23 were recaptured, 6 were shot and killed, 2 drowned, and 5 are listed as missing or presumed drowned. It's these that have been the subject of myth and mystery for decades. That's what we're talking about today on The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
The first inmate we're talking about today is Frank Lee Morris. Born September 1st, 1926, and disappeared June 11th, 1962. He was born in Washington, D.C. He was abandoned by his mother and father during his childhood and orphaned at age 11 and spent most of his formative years in foster homes. He was convicted of his first crime at age 13 and by his late teens had been arrested for crimes ranging from narcotics possession to armed robbery. He spent most of his early years in jail serving lunch to prisoners. As he got older, he was arrested for grand larceny in Miami Beach for stealing cars and armed robbery. The Associate Warden's record card at Alcatraz Prison lists his crimes involved as Juvenile Delinquent 2, Runaways 2, Breaking and Entering 1, Burglary 1, Narcotics and Armed Robbery 1, Unlawful Fight, Man Act, and Bank Robbery 1. Morris reportedly ranked in the top 2% of the general population in intelligence, as measured by IQ testing, displaying an IQ of 133. He served time in Florida and Georgia, then escaped from the Louisiana State Penitentiary while serving 10 years for bank robbery. He was recaptured a year later while committing a burglary and sent to Alcatraz on January 20th, 1960 as inmate number AZ-1441. John and Clarence Anglin. The Anglin brothers, John William, born May 2nd, 1930, disappeared June 11th, 1962, and Clarence, born May 11th, 1931, disappeared June 11th, 1962, were born into a family of 13 children in Donaldsville, Georgia. Their parents, George Robert Anglin and Rachel Van Miller Anglin, were seasonal farm workers in the early 1940s. They moved the family to Ruskin, Florida, 20 miles south of Tampa, where the truck farms and tomato fields provided a more reliable source of income. Each June, they migrated north as far as Michigan to pick cherries. Clarence Anglin was known to have a tattoo of Zona on his left wrist and one of Nita on his right upper arm. The brothers worked as farmers and laborers. Clarence was first caught breaking into a service station when he was just 14 years old. They began robbing banks and other establishments as a team in the early 1950s, usually targets that were closed to ensure that no one got injured. They claimed they used a weapon only once during a bank heist, a toy gun. They were arrested in 1958 after robbing the Bank of Columbia branch in Columbia, Alabama. In 1958, John Anglin robbed the Columbia Savings Bank building with a toy gun together with his brothers Clarence and Alfred. Both received 15 to 20 year sentences, which they served at Florida State Prison, Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary, and then Atlanta Penitentiary. After repeated failed attempts to escape from the Atlanta facility, the brothers were transferred to Alcatraz. John arrived on October 24, 1960 as inmate AZ-1476, and Clarence on January 10, 1961 as inmate AZ-1485. Alan Clayton West was born on March 25, 1929. He was born in New York City. He was imprisoned for car theft in 1955, first at Atlanta Penitentiary, then at Florida State Prison. After an unsuccessful escape attempt from the Florida facility, he was transferred to Alcatraz in 1957 and became inmate AZ-1335. When West was transferred to Alcatraz, he was 28 years old and had the education of an eighth grader. West was arrested over 20 times throughout his lifetime. In December of 1978, suffering severe abdominal pains, West was sent to Shandon's Teaching Hospital, where he died at the age of 49. As soon as the four inmates were assigned adjacent cells in December of 1961, they began formulating the escape plan together. Though always under the leadership of Morris, the chief mastermind and unilateral orchestrator of the plot, it helped to ensure their mutual trust that they already knew each other from their time in the Atlanta prison years before. Over the subsequent 6 months, the men widened the ventilation ducts beneath their sinks using discarded saw blades found on the prison grounds, metal spoons smuggled from the mess hall, and an electric drill improvised from the motor of a vacuum cleaner. The men concealed the progress of their holes, the walls of painted cardboard, and the noise of their work with the louder noise of Morris's accordion on top of the ambient din of Music Hour. One of the holes were wide enough to pass through. The escapees nightly accessed the utility corridor left unguarded directly behind their cell tier and climbed into the vacant top level of the cell block where they sat up a clandestine workshop unbeknownst to prison staff. Here, with over 50 raincoats among other stolen and donated materials, they constructed life preservers based on the design one of them chanced to find in Popular Mechanics, as well as 6x14-foot rubber rafts, the seams carefully stitched by hand and sealed by steam pipes heat. Having manufactured the raft, they inflated it with a mix rigged to serve as bellows and furnished the necessary paddles from scrap wood and screws. Finally, they climbed up a ventilation shaft bound for the roof and, finding a ponderous fan grill in the way, removed the rivets holding it in place. The men concealed their absence while working outside their cells and after the escape itself by sculpting dummy heads from a homemade papier-mâché-like mixture of soap, toothpaste, concrete, dust, and toilet paper, and giving them a realistic appearance with paint from the maintenance shop and hair from the barbershop floor. With towels and clothing piled under their blankets and their bunks and the dummy heads positioned on the pillows, they appeared to be sleeping. On the night of June 11, 1962, with all preparations in place, the men began their escape. However, the cement employed to shore up crumbling concrete around West's vent had hardened, diminishing the hole in size and fixing the grill in place. By the time he managed to remove the grill and re-widen the hole to egress, the others had already left and he was soon to discover. He busted out to the prison roof, only to return to his cell around sunrise and go to sleep. West went on to cooperate fully with investigators and give them a detailed description of the escape plan, in consequence of which he was not punished for his role in it. From the service coordinator, Morris and the Anglins climbed the ventilation shaft to the roof. Guards heard a loud crash as they broke out the shaft, but since nothing further was heard, the source of the noise was not investigated. Hauling their gear with them, they descended 50 feet to the ground by sliding down a kitchen vent pipe, then climbed two 12-foot barbed wire perimeter fences at the northeast shoreline near the power plant. A blind spot in the prison's network of searchlights and gun tower, they inflated their raft. At some point after 10 p.m., investigators estimated they boarded the raft, launched it, and departed towards their objective, Angel Island, 2 miles to the north. So this is the dark side of Wikipedia today, talking about the Alcatraz escapes. And it's interesting because we to this day don't necessarily know if they were attempted and successful or just attempted and failed. But it's one of those unsolved mysteries that still remains out there.
Yeah, that's true.
How much do you know about the Alcatraz escape attempts and things of that nature other than what you saw on The Rock?
Well, not so much The Rock, but more the old Clint Eastwood escape from Alcatraz.
Never saw that.
Yeah, that's the only one that I've seen that really was about this.
It portrays these characters?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's been a long time ago that I saw that. I'm sure I watched it with my dad when I was a kid, but I don't really remember a whole lot other than I knew that there were some that got away that they weren't sure if they lived or not.
If you could escape from Alcatraz, would you attempt?
Well, I don't know because, I mean, like they said, one of the guys was like in the genius category.
Yeah.
I don't know that I could figure out how to do it. I mean, I know I've got nothing but time sitting in there to figure it out, but it'd be something to try and something to work on.
I think you could figure it out and you'd probably make like a really cute decor tunnel along the way where it's like, oh, look at the shiplap that she put up along
this. She left a little barn door. Okay.
That's really, they put a lot of effort into these like little secret areas.
I don't know. Would you?
I don't know. I mean, the assumption would be you can make it to the water.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say you could. Mm-hmm. You figure that out. You made it to the water. You're not being shot at. You have a clear shot to get out. But but then it's you, the water, and distance.
Mm-hmm.
Would you make that attempt or would you sit there and try and wait out your 15, 20 year sentence or whatever? What's funny about these sentences were not like lifetime sentences that a lot of these guys had, which I was unaware of. I would assume that if you're in there for life, I guess, I think that would make a difference.
Yeah.
In terms of whether I would make the attempt or not, seeing as so many others had failed at it.
I don't know because I know the risk of hypothermia and dying, you know, from a cramp or something halfway there. I'd rather not drown.
Yeah.
That's like one of my ultimate fears is the fear of drowning. So I don't know that I would do it just for that reason.
Your odds of dying like one of the worst ways possible are super high if you get out there. But it's also you could get out there.
But I've never been in prison, so I can't give you an honest, you know, educated answer as to whether I would try and escape Alcatraz.
No, it's just an interesting thought. On a homemade, would you feel confident enough in a homemade life raft?
I don't know about with the materials that I could find. I mean, if I had materials that I could just go get and then put it together, sure, I could build something that would float me over there, but I'm not gonna
raincoats
it, you know, with raincoats and piping. I mean,
that's
part of the reason we don't know if they made it or not, because we'd never found that on Angel Island or the other side.
That's the interesting thing. Let's continue into the story about the attempted escapes or possibly successful escapes from Alcatraz. The escape was not discovered until the morning of June 12, 1962, due to successful dummy head use. At the time of the escape, Warden Olin G. Blackwell was on vacation in Lake Barissa in Napa County, California, and he did not believe the men could have survived the waters and made it to shore. In a joint effort, multiple military and law enforcement agencies conducted an extensive air, sea, and land search over the next 10 days. On June 14th, a Coast Guard cutter picked up a paddle floating around 200 yards off the southern shore of Angel Island. The same day, in the same general location, workers on another boat found a wallet wrapped in plastic, complete with names, addresses, and photos of the Anglin's friends and relatives. On June 21st, shreds of raincoat material believed to be remnants of the raft were found on a beach not far from the Golden Gate Bridge. The following day, a prison boat picked up a deflated life jacket made from the same material 50 yards off Alcatraz Island. No other physical evidence of the man's fate were ever found. According to the final FBI report, the escapee's raft was never recovered. The FBI officials were at least publicly positive the men had drowned. They cited the fact that the individual's personal effects were the only belongings they had, and the men would have drowned before leaving them behind. However, when authorities searched for bodies, none were found. Patrick Mahoney, who ran the launch that traveled between Alcatraz and the mainland, had some doubts that the men perished, saying, "I felt that they didn't make it, but I thought we'd find a body." We didn't find a body. As U.S. Marshal Michael Dyke told the news, the bodies of 2 out of every 3 people who go missing in the San Francisco Bay are eventually recovered. During the investigation, Robert Chechi, a San Francisco police officer, said that at 1 a.m. on the morning of June 12th, he saw an illegal boat in the bay near Alcatraz. A few minutes later, the boat left, heading under the Golden Gate Bridge. This led to speculation that the prisoners might well have enlisted outside Confederates to pick them up by boat. During the investigation, the FBI dismissed Chechi's account of the island as being out of hand. According to FBI reports, on July 17, 1962, a month after the escape, the Norwegian ship SS Norfleel spotted the body of one person floating in the ocean 15 nautical miles from the Golden Gate Bridge. The ship did not retrieve the body and did not report the sighting until October. San Francisco County Coroner Henry Turkle cast doubt on speculation that it could have been one of the escapees, emphasizing the improbability that a body would still be floating on the surface of the ocean after more than a month. Instead, Turkle proposed that the corpses may have been that of Cecil Phillips Herman, a 34-year-old unemployed baker who had committed suicide by jumping from the Golden Gate Bridge 5 days earlier. Several coroners from neighboring counties challenged Turkle's opinion, stating that it was possible for the remains to have belonged to one of the escapees. Human bones were located 8 months after the escape, having washed up on the shore to the north of the Golden Gate Bridge at Point Reyes, near the place where the Norwegian ship had spotted a body. The bones were recovered and buried under the name John Bones Doe. At the time, a pathology report on the bones indicated that they had belonged to a man of Morris's age and height, but was otherwise inconclusive. FBI investigators announced their official position to the public that while it was theoretically possible that for the men to have reached Angel Island, the odds of them having survived the turbulent currents and frigid waters of the bay were negligible. In what doubts served to shore up the line of official denial, the final FBI report followed the disclosure that the escapees, as per West, had planned to steal clothes and a car upon reaching land, with a categorical insistence that no such thefts whatsoever were reported in the immediate area. West was the only conspirator not to participate in the actual escape. He could not get his ventilator grill unstuck to leave his cell in time, so the others were forced to leave him behind. He fully cooperated with the investigation into the escape and was therefore not charged with a role. West was transferred to McNeil Island, Washington, when Alcatraz was deactivated in 1963, and later back to Atlanta Penitentiary. After serving a sentence followed by 2 additional sentences in Georgia and Florida, he was released in 1967, only to be arrested again in Florida the following year on charges of grand larceny. At Florida State Prison, he fatally stabbed another inmate in October of 1972 in what may have been a racially motivated incident. He was serving multiple sentences, including life imprisonment on the murder conviction, when he died of something in October of 1978. On December 16, 1962, inmate John Paul Scott successfully swam a distance of 2.7 nautical miles from Alcatraz to Fort Point at the southern end of the Golden Gate Bridge. He was found there by teenagers suffering from hypothermia and exhaustion. After recovering in Letterman General Hospital, he was immediately returned to Alcatraz. It's the only proven case of an Alcatraz inmate reaching the shore by swimming. Scott's escape, undertaken in slightly more unfavorable conditions than Morris and the Anglins faced, and using a means of flotation that was far inferior to the raft constructed by Morris, Scott made water wings by inflating stolen rubber gloves, shook the line of reasoning that Morris and the Anglins had likely drowned. Today, a multiple of athletes swim the same Alcatraz to Fort Point route as part of 1 of 2 annual triathlon events. Because the penitentiary costs much more to operate than other prisons, nearly $10 per prisoner per day as opposed to $3 per prisoner per day at Atlanta, and half a century of saltwater saturation had severely eroded the buildings, then Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy ordered the penitentiary closed on March 21, 1963. The FBI closed its file on December 31, 1979, after a 17-year investigation. Their official finding was that the prisoners most likely drowned in the cold waters of the bay while attempting to reach Angel Island, it being unlikely that they made it the 1.25 miles to shore with the strong ocean currents and cold seawater temperature ranging between 50 and 55 degrees Fahrenheit. They cited the remains found of the raft as well as the personal effects of the men as evidence to bolster the official line that the raft broke up and sank at some point after having launched from Alcatraz, and that the three convicts tried to swim for it but then surely succumbed to hypothermia. Their bodies swept to sea by the rapid currents of the San Francisco Bay. However, the FBI did hand the investigators over to the U.S. Marshals Service, who have not closed there since. As Deputy U.S. Marshal Michael Dyke told NPR in 2009, there's an active warrant and the Marshals Service doesn't give up looking for people. Dyke also pointed out that the bodies of two out of every three people who go missing in San Francisco Bay are eventually recovered. It's a very interesting case to hear how they got out there, that people have swam it and been just fine. Athletes today swim it as part of a triathlon, so it is not impossible to be done. We'll go into the reported sightings in just a few moments, but so thus far, what do you think?
I think it takes a lot of training to prepare for that kind of swim, and I don't think they had access to any kind of swimming facility to prepare for that, so... I mean, in prisons, some prisons, I would imagine maybe there's pools now. I have no idea. It depends on what level of security it is. But I don't think there was on Alcatraz. But I definitely think these guys would have had to train to make that swim.
Yeah, I would definitely think so. But at the same point, the one guy was extremely intelligent. And if you're trying to throw someone off and you want to try and get out there and live and not be searched for the next 30, 40, 50 years, you want people to think you're dead.
Yeah.
So the idea of leaving a wallet behind, the idea of destroying your raft or making it look like it was destroyed would probably be part of your plan.
That or killing one of your float mates.
Yeah.
To make it look like nobody made it.
Yeah, it's like we made it this far. Sorry, mate. Then dead. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways that could have been done. You know, as a cover. Mm-hmm. I'm interested to hear about the escape. I think this was like on Unsolved Mysteries once when we were kids.
Probably.
I'm pretty sure it was, but it's always been an intriguing case to me. Let's continue in to the area of the chapters here on Wikipedia of reported sightings, possibly, of the men after the escape. Since the escape of the three men, there have been many sightings of them reported and leads to their whereabouts submitted. A day after the escape, a man claiming to be John Anglin called a lawyer, Eugenia McGowan, in San Francisco to arrange a meeting with the U.S. Marshal's office. When McGowan refused, the caller terminated the phone call. The FBI dismissed the call as a prank. In January of 1965, the FBI investigated a rumor that Clarence Anglin was living in Brazil. It was considered so significant that agents were dispatched to South America to find him. A male tipster called the Bureau in 1967 claiming to have been at school with Morris and having known him for 30 years. He said he bumped into him in Maryland and described him as having a small beard and mustache, but refused to give further details. Family members of the Anglin brothers occasionally received many unsigned postcards and messages over the years. One card came signed Jerry, another Jerry and Joe. The family also produced a Christmas card purportedly received in the family mailbox in 1962, saying to Mother from John, Merry Christmas. Another of the Anglin's 11 siblings, Robert, also said that sometimes the phone would ring and all that could be heard was breathing on the other end, Robert said. I suppose all that could have been pranks, but maybe it was my brother's. The mother of the Anglin brothers received flowers anonymously every Mother's Day until her death in 1973. And two very tall, unusual women in heavy makeup were reported to have attended her funeral before disappearing. Federal officials say that the mid to late 1960s and into the 1970s, there were six or seven sightings reported of the Anglin brothers, all in North Florida or Georgia. Robert also said that in 1989, when the father of the Anglin brothers died, two strangers in beards showed up at the funeral home. According to Robert, they stood in front of the casket looking at the body a few minutes They wept, then they walked out, he said. In 1989, a woman who only identified herself as Kathy called Unsolved Mysteries a tip line to report that she recognized a photo of Clarence Anglin as a man who lived on the farm near Marina, Florida. The brothers were also linked to the area by a woman who recognized the photo of Clarence Anglin and said he lived near Marina. She correctly identified his eye color, height, and other physical features. Another witness identified a sketch of Frank Moore, saying it bore a striking resemblance to a man she had seen in the area. In the early 2000s, according to the New York Times bestselling author Frank M. Aaron, the U.S. Marshals received a tip that one of the Anglin brothers was in Brazil. The U.S. Marshals went down to Brazil and got a confirmation from a local bartender that one of the brothers was there. Deputy U.S. Marshal Michael Dyke told NPR in 2009 that he still received leads on a regular basis. The escape was investigated in a segment by Robert Stack in 1989 on Unsolved Mysteries. Two theories were tested, one by having a triathlete swim from Alcatraz to the mainland, and the other three having experienced kayakers paddle the same route in a replica of the makeshift raft used by the Anglins and Moores. While the rafters failed due to their raft being unseaworthy and had to be rescued by a motorboat that was shadowing their progress, the swimmers succeeded in making it to shore. In 1993, a former Alcatraz inmate named Thomas Kent told the television program America's Most Wanted that he had helped plan the escape and claimed to have provided significant new leads to investigators. He said that Clarence and Anglin's girlfriend had agreed to meet the men on shore and drive them to Mexico. He declined to participate in the actual escapes, he said, because he could not swim. Officials were skeptical of Kent's account because he had been paid $2,000 for the interview. Art Roderick, a retired deputy U.S. Marshal, investigated a man named John Leroy Kelly, who died in 1993, who dictated an extended deathbed confession to his nurse. Kelly claimed that he and his partner picked up Morris and the Anglins from the bay in a boat and transported them to the Seattle, Washington area. Later, under the guise of transporting the three escaped convicts to Canada, Kelly and his partner double-crossed and murdered the escapees to get the $40,000 their families had collected for them. Kelly, feeling lifelong guilt over his part, felt obligated to confess what he did to a priest and to his nurse. Roderick and others found a location in Seattle where Kelly said the three escapees were buried. A dig at the site failed to turn up any bones. Modern experimental and computer-simulated evidence has suggested that the ultimate outcome of the attempt may have depended on the exact time of the men's departure aboard the raft and where they were sitting on top of the raft using their paddles or partially submerged in the water clinging to the raft and using their legs as the primary propelling force. A 2003 Mythbusters episode on the Discovery Channel tested the feasibility of an escape from the island aboard the raft constructed with the same materials and tools available to the inmates and determined that it was possible. Contrary to the inmates' intended destination after escaping Alcatraz, being Angel Island, the Mythbusters theorized that the escapees used the tides to go to a different location. The makeshift raft, crafted and crewed by the Mythbusters team, successfully made it across the bay and made it to the Marin Headlands, a portion of the scale test, cut for time but later shown in Mythbusters outtakes, also shows that debris found in the bay afterwards could have been released by the prisoners to float to where they were found through strategic use by the bay's tides to throw the authorities off their trail. The Mythbusters explored the idea that the paddle that was found floated back into the bay in the direction of Angel Island after the prisoners made it to the Marin Headlands as a way to throw off the FBI on their trail. Using a scale model of the San Francisco Bay Area, the tide could have washed the paddle in the direction of Angel Island if released from the Marin Headlands. But as with their theory of how the escape could have succeeded, no concrete evidence existed to prove or disprove the theory. When the case was transferred from the FBI to the U.S. Marshals, all the files were examined in detail on a 2011 documentary on the National Geographic Channel entitled Vanished from Alcatraz. Michael Dyke, the deputy U.S. Marshal, discovered in the newly uncovered official records, it was reported that contrary to the official FBI report of the escapees' raft never being recovered or no car theft being reported, a raft was discovered on Angel Island on June 12, 1962, the day after the escape. It was also reported that footprints were leading away from the raft. Furthermore, it was reported that a car, a 1955 blue Chevrolet with California license plate KPB076, had been reported stolen in Marin County the day after the escape. It was also reported that at 11:30 a.m. on June 12th, a motorist in Stockton, California, 80 miles east of San Francisco, reported to the California Highway Patrol that he had been forced off the road by three men in a blue Chevrolet. Researchers did some digging and discovered that the information was not new at all. In fact, several newspapers actually reported the theft of the car, matching the story in the documents. According to Dyke, there were boats docked on the opposite side of Angel Island, and so the inmates could have gained access to one of them and gotten to the mainland. This discovery prompted speculation that officials knew of the evidence, suggesting the trio survived and that a cover-up of the evidence had taken place, along with them declaring the men drowned, not only to save Alcatraz's reputation as an escape-proof prison, but to hope the escapees would relax and then become easier targets to find. During Vanished from Alcatraz, Marshall Dyke exhumed the remains of John Bones Doe, and DNA from the bones was compared to a DNA sample from one of Morris's paternal relatives. The DNA did not match, and so the bones were not Morris. That same year, an 89-year-old man named Bud Morris, who claimed he was a cousin of Frank Morris, claimed that on 8 or 9 occasions prior to the escape, he delivered envelopes of money to Alcatraz guards, presumably as bribes. He further claimed to have met his cousin face-to-face in San Diego Park shortly after his escape. His daughter, who was 8 or 9 years old at the time, said she was present at the meeting with Dad's friend Frank, but had no idea about the escape. His story and his relation to Morris has never been proven. In 2012, the 50th anniversary of the escape attempt, Michael Dyke, the deputy U.S. Marshal, concealed that he still receives leads once in a while regarding the case, and there are still active warrants. That same year, the Anglins' two sisters, Marie Anglin Winder and Merle Anglin Taylor, and two of the Anglins' nephews, David and Kenneth Winder, made public their belief that another of the Anglins' 11 siblings, Alfred, who was electrocuted while attempting to escape from Kilby Prison in Montgomery, Alabama in 1964, was actually beaten to death by guards because he would not help investigators locate his brother. A 2014 study of the ocean currents by scientists at Delft University and the research institute Deltres indicates that the prisoners left Alcatraz at 11:30 p.m. on June 11th. They could have made it to Horseshoe Bay just north of the Golden Gate Bridge, and that any debris released into the bay would have floated in the direction of Angel Island, consistent with where the paddle and belongings of the prisoners were actually found. A 2015 History Channel documentary entitled Alcatraz, Search for the Truth, presented further circumstantial evidence gathered over the years by the Anglin family. Kenneth and David Widner displayed Christmas cards containing the Anglins' handwriting and allegedly received by family members for 3 years after the escape. While the handwriting was verified as the Anglins', none of the envelopes contained a postmark, stamp, so experts could not determine when they had been delivered. The family cited a story from a friend, Fred Breezy, who grew up with the brothers and claimed to have recognized them in Rio de Janeiro in 1975. They produced photographs taken, they said, by Breezy, including one showing two men who, according to Breezy, were John and Clarence Anglin, standing next to a large termite mound, as well as several showing what they claimed was a Brazilian farm purportedly owned by the men. Forensic experts confirmed that the photos were taken in 1975 and asserted that the two men were, more than likely, the Anglins. Breezy's story also presented an alternative escape theory. According to him, the escapees did not use the raft to cross the bay, but instead paddle around the island to the boat dock, where they then escaped by attaching a length of an electrical cord, which had been reported missing from the prison's dock on the night of the escape, to the rudder of a prison ferry boat that departed the island shortly after midnight and were towed along behind it as it sailed to the mainland, after which they untied the cord and paddled to the boat seen by eyewitnesses and former police officer Robert Chechi. During the documentary, the family gave permission for Alfred Anglin's body to be dug up from the family cemetery in Ruskin, Florida. A coroner did not find any significant trauma to Alfred, confirming his cause of death was most likely electrocution, but Alfred's DNA was compared with a sample from John Bones Doe. It was not a match, and so the bones did not belong to either Anglin brother. Art Roderick, working with the Anglin family, called Breezy's photograph of the two men absolutely the best actionable lead we've had, but added it would still be a nice story, which isn't true. Or the photograph could be misdirection aimed at steering the investigation away from the Anglin's actual whereabouts. Michael Dyke, the deputy marshal assigned to the case, said Breezy was a drug smuggler and a con man and was suspicious of his account. Breezy's widow had declared that she never heard him mention ever seeing the Anglin brothers in Rio, and she frankly admitted that he was a con man who was prone to making up stories. An expert working for the U.S. Marshals Service compared measurements of the photo subject's physical features to those of the Anglin brothers' arrest photos, believe it most likely is a picture of John and Clarence Anglin, although the age and condition of the photo and the fact that both men were wearing sunglasses hindered efforts to make a definitive determination. Other circumstantial evidence included the deathbed confessions of Robert Anglin, who is said to have told family members in 2010 that he had been in contact with John and Clarence from 1963 until approximately 1987. Surviving family members who said they have heard nothing since Robert lost contact with the brothers in 1987 announced plans to travel to Brazil to conduct a personal search, but Roderick cautioned that they could be arrested by Brazilian authorities because the Alcatraz escape remains an open Interpol case. In a 2016 episode of American PBS television series Secrets of the Dead, three Dutch scientists using tidal flow data tried to recreate the attempt, creating handmade replicas of the raft and paddles. They tried for Horseshoe Bay, which they considered a more realistic landing site, while the rafters failed due to their raft being unseaworthy, had to be rescued by a motorboat that was shadowing their progress. They almost made it to the shore. In 2018, the FBI confirmed that the existence of a letter allegedly written by John Anglin had compelled them to reopen the investigation into the case. The author of the letter, received by the San Francisco Police Department in 2013, asserts that Frank Morris died in 2008 and was buried in Alexandria under a different name, and that Clarence Anglin died in 2011. The alleged Anglin further states that he had cancer and wants to strike a deal with the FBI, offering to be locked up again for a year in exchange for medical care. When analyzed for a link to Anglin, it was deemed inconclusive. The U.S. Marshal's Office is still investigating the case, which will remain open until all three escapees hit their 100th birthdays. The centennial of the birth of Clarence Anglin, the youngest of the escapees, is May 11th, 2031. On an episode of the series Mission Declassified, investigative journalist Christoph Putzel investigated the escape. Paddling with two other men in a replica of the makeshift raft used by the Anglins and Morris, they determined that due to the shifting tide, it is plausible that the trio could have paddled to Angel Island without a great degree of difficulty. Noting the documents mentioning a raft being found in Angel Island and the 1955 blue Chevrolet being stolen, Putzel combed through the hundreds of documents and discovered various reports mentioning a Chevy of the same description making its way across the country over a couple months after the escape. According to one report, 2 weeks after the escape, a Chevy was spotted in Oklahoma with men who met the description of the escapees. A Chevy discovered in Indiana, a Chevy spotted in Ohio, and in South Carolina, 3 months after the initial escape. Three men matching the description of the Anglin brothers and Frank Morris trying to acquire a hideout in the woods. Interviewing Kenneth Winder, Widner had to say about Morris, "In letters and conversations I've had with certain people, there's very good indication that he left. I did kind of hear where I thought he went." Putzel traveled to Brazil, where he discovered that there was a farm called the Farm of the Americans, and learned that the residents recalled of two American men renting the farm and living there from 1965 to the 1970s, and discovered the nearby site of the 1975 photograph called El Dorado, discovering similar large termite mounds similar to the one in the photo. In January of 2020, Rothko, an Irish creative agency, teamed up with AI specialists to identify and analyze the alleged photo of the Anglin brothers in Brazil. using facial recognition techniques, a new network that was trained on past images of the brothers and confirmed with high confidence that the identities of the men in the photo were John and Clarence Anglin. So according to that photo app that we were all playing with at the beginning of 2020 that ages us, it was them. No, it wasn't. That's not what they used, but...
I think it's interesting they only keep it open till they're 100 and then they just don't.
Well, I mean, there's no more searching for them.
No, but it's still, don't you kind of need to know?
You'd want the evidence. I mean, I think that's where it probably maybe it's 100% up to private investigators or mystery solvers or whatnot to try and do it. And maybe the federal authorities just say, you know, we spent enough time on this. We have other things that are more pressing right now to deal with.
Yeah.
But it is certainly still, you know, there's so many ways that people are certain this ended. Mm-hmm. You know, they're certain that, you know, the guy who made the deathbed confession that he killed them in Washington State while trying to get them to Canada to collect $40,000. That's an interesting one.
Well, but what did he didn't collect anything.
Did he or did he not?
Well, if he killed them to collect money,
then
we'd have bodies and we'd know.
Yeah, that's true. And he said where he said he buried them, they did not find the evidence. But then you have the photographs, you have the people who say that they saw him, you have the little girl of, it was basically the niece of one of them saying, yeah, I remember going to the park with dad and him talking to this guy and I didn't realize who it was at the time. There's so many things that really point to them having survived. So if I were to make a guess, if I were putting money on it and we, at the end of some year, we're going to have a true answer, I would say they made it. As to where they made it to or their whereabouts, that is still, I think that's the mystery more than if they survived.
I hope if they're on their deathbeds, they leave notes saying, yeah, that's who I am and I made it and here's how.
It was me all this time, bitches. Yeah, it would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You would hope if you went through all that and you're about to die, why not?
Yeah.
Why not just say, I won, I did it. You got nothing to lose at that point.
Right.
And then it really is kind of your triumphant, you know, flag of look what I did. I don't know. I wonder if we'll ever see. I mean, seeing as recently as January of 2020, there was still another page to the book added. So I can imagine there'll still be more pages to this book to be added in. That's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our show, press subscribe wherever you download podcasts, and please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Until next time, for Jenny and all of us at Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's time to find furniture that feels like the one. Shop Haverty's Memorial Day Sale and save on furniture backed by a regret-free guarantee. Plus, explore fresh styles arriving just in time for summer. Visit Haverty's online or in-store in Columbus at Polaris.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for. With SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just 10 bucks. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Lots of places can accidentally expose you to identity theft. Doctor's offices, online retailers, insurance companies, the list goes on. Thankfully, LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. LifeLock keeps an eye on your personal information, credit applications, finances, and more. And if they find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, they alert you right away. All through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Even better, alerts are automatically activated the moment you become a LifeLock member. No extra work on your part. Get the alerts that could make all the difference. Don't wait. Join LifeLock now. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 40% your first year. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.